Good morning. Welcome. I want to greet each of you in Jesus' name. Hope I'm not getting lazy, probably due to some personal things. I found it a little hard the last while to come up with messages that I don't feel circle around more than they should, maybe. And so I had a number assigned elsewhere that I was working on, so I guess I'll just sort of follow one of those again. And this is one I probably would have never got to. I say never. I think I've touched on it. But so far as actually having a message on this subject, I'm not sure if I'd have got to it on my own. So you can thank a youth committee elsewhere for that. But maybe before I get into it, a little bit of a quiz is, so how many of you say you know the Ten Commandments? You say you know them? Okay, good. Okay, so who can tell me what the fifth one is? I'll be honest, I had went and counted, double-checked myself, so I know I'm right. So you go ahead and see if you can get it. What's the fifth of the Ten Commandments? Well, thanks for being brave enough to try, but unfortunately, no. Okay, thank you. So if you look, at least in the list, it has an Exodus and also in Deuteronomy. I think it's the same. Exodus 20, verse 12. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. For some reason, in my mind, that was sixth. Now, I'm not sure how I got that order twisted, but in checking how other people counted, it seemed like that's generally considered the fifth. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. So the... not necessarily completely what I'm doing here for the youth. The title is supposed to be relating to parents or something down that line. I just called this the fifth commandment, and I'll probably touch on both sides of it a little bit more since I have more of a mixed group here. In the men's class, we could hardly get done on some things involving the home and things, so maybe you can just take those thoughts and continue somewhat spill over into this, because I'd be glad for any feedback you have for me again. In some ways, I wonder if I'm not the last man standing, or at least the last man here that should be preaching on this. Maybe I can share on it. Because it's one of those commands, I know it's repeated in the New Testament. I know the Bible commands it. And I would say I accept it. Yet somehow it's not something I've focused on a lot, at least recently. I don't know why that is. And in studying this, I was just personally convicted, I guess, in a few areas and thinking of my past and even more the present of where I could have done a better job on this. And maybe I'll get into some of that. Just briefly, I mean, while I appreciate my parents and stuff, I guess I would just say Dad and I are very different personalities and run on somewhat different frequencies. And especially in my late teens, that caused, made me a lot of stress. I didn't know if Dad got stressed out. He probably did. I've actually never asked him that. But in thinking, a lot of that's changed as life has changed. But at the same time, recently I had an episode here again, and I'll share it not to make him look foolish at all, but we pulled that RV to Laredo, Texas, where a nephew by marriage, married to my niece, met us, and Dad was along, and I'm supposed to be taking care of some business up here for him that he can't do down there, and he was talking about how much money he has in a couple different accounts up here, and he was referring to the one that I call checking. He kept calling it savings, and so I left it go for a while, and then I told him, Dad, I think you got those two switched around, because I just looked it up for the amounts, and it definitely said that this is a checking account on what you're calling savings. And he just told me, he said, no, you're mixed up. He said, I know you got it switched around your head, and I don't know why you do, but it's the other way. And thinking about that, how do I honor my dad when he's just flat wrong? Because I looked again, and I still think I'm right, to be honest with you. I think he's mixed up. I don't know. That's a huge issue in this case. For some reason, he calls that thing savings in his mind. So how do I honor? That's just a very small thing. But how do I honor in such a situation? And I felt I made it a bigger deal than I needed to. So I called him up. this morning, actually, and just told him that where I failed in that or anything else, I'm sorry. I don't feel like I want to preach a message like this with something on my mind. At the same time, it's definitely something that I have a lot of things I could have done differently. So we'll just start Exodus. I've got a lot of scripture. I invite you to turn to it, but I'm not necessarily going to emphasize that heavily all the time. So the first one, of course, is Exodus chapter 20, verse 12, which I read already. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which thy Lord thy God giveth thee. In thinking about the word honor there, I looked that up. The Hebrew word translated honor here is an extremely broad one. Strong's had so many different words and they meant so many different things. I wasn't sure how you could squeeze that all out of honor. In my sort of trying to condense it and put it in my own words, the word translated honor here in Hebrew could mean anything in the negative sense, to have a heavy and burdensome duty. Honor your parents when it's heavy and burdensome. It sort of could be one thought of it, but it also has a positive thought, which would be, and again in my own words, could mean richly and fully glorify your parents as well. So, like I said, there's a wide range. So in trying to understand exactly what God was looking for, I went over to Leviticus chapter 19, where it's somewhat repeated and then expanded in Leviticus on most of the Ten Commandments and some other things. So in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 2 and 3, God says this, Speak unto all the congregation of the children of Israel and say unto them, ye shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And then he says, ye shall fear every man his mother and his father and keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Now, if you look up that word that's translated fear, it means simply to revere or actually to be afraid of. So I don't know. When I actually felt afraid of Dad, I don't know that I ever felt like I was honoring him. I don't know how that strikes you. That seems a little bit odd, because generally when I was afraid, it was because I had some cause to be afraid, if you follow what I'm saying. But I guess as I would interpret this, if I may, to some, to revere would definitely have the thought to be in respect of. And if that involves a certain amount of fear of judgment, I think in God that's a right thing, and especially for a smaller child, there rightly is some fear. If you've been doing the exact thing you were told not to do, there should probably be some fear as you think of Dad or Mom finding you in that situation, right? So if you want to pertain it that way, but honor. Honor. So then, like I said, this is brought over in the New Testament. Christ speaks of it. I'll get to those verses a bit later, but probably the first ones I'll read are Ephesians and then Colossians. So Ephesians 6, first three verses probably most of us can say by memory, it's reiterated. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Verse 2, honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. So I looked up the Greek word now, translated honor here, and it struck me as interesting, the difference between the Old and the New Covenant, in that the Greek word translated honor here has a little different twist. It's more precise. And in the way it's used here, it means to prize or value. So now going from being, if I may play on this a little bit, going from somewhat of being a duty, heavy, cumbersome, yeah, I need to honor my parents no matter how, whatever they are. Now I value my parents highly and I prize them. And so now I honor them. More of a Christian mindset about honoring your parents, I guess if I may say so. And that difference in the two words just blessed me. Hope it's not, I'm explaining it correctly. Another word we should consider in Ephesians 6 here, the first verse 1, is children, obey your parents. And looking at obey, it means to listen to them, first of all, to hear respectfully, and to put yourself as being subordinate, being under them. To heed and conform, to do what you're told to, basically. And the same thought word, actually the same Greek word, is used in Colossians chapter 3, verse 20, where it says, children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. So can we take those things at face value? And I think we should. I'm not here to explain away, but do we just, regardless of age, regardless of circumstances, do each one of us call Dad, Mom up at the beginning of the day, wherever we find ourselves, as if we have some anyways, and say, what should I do today? Is that what those of you that still have them do? Now, maybe those of you that are no longer here, you'd be sort of glad if you could. I don't know. Some of that things change, doesn't it? And I've been struck. I still have my parents, but in the last couple years, seeing others lose their parents, that day is coming for me as well, at least unless I go first. You know, there'd just be something missing. But is that what he's saying? Or is he asking for, is there a broader picture? Is there something else that God is trying to say more than that a 30, 40, 50-year-old is calling up dad and asking him how he should do everything? What is God after? Why does he tell us this? Because there's no, can I say, statute of limitations given, is it? Does he say children obey your parents until you're 20? Just to put an age there. I didn't. My Bible doesn't say that. Maybe yours does. So I'd like to make this practical. And there's another phrase, actually, I sort of ran ahead of myself. There's another phrase in verse 2 that sort of stood out to me, and I was ruling it around. I'd like, if you have a different thought, feel free with it, testimony time or personally. But it says, honor thy father and the mother, which is the first commandment with promise. What does that mean? Where does this thing of the first commandment with promise come from? If you go back and look at the Ten Commandments, the first four are basically God telling them that they're not to take his name in vain, to have graven images, all that. And he gives them some reasons. He tells them that I'm the God that brought you out of Egypt, and so therefore you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. But when he gets to honoring parents, it's the first one where he actually makes a promise that you will experience something different if you do this. And in the Old Testament, and in more of a physical, can I say physical, temporal blessing, it was that your days will be long in the land. You'll live longer. And, you know, even today, in a physical way, that's still true, right? If you tell your 5-year-old child to stay off the road, they'll probably live longer if they listen to you than if they don't. It's very basic. But even as we look at the culture, the society we find ourselves into, you know, this is a command that's probably neglected as right along with all the rest. And, you know, there's a price that's paid. Where there's no honor for parents, where children are not taught to honor, there's a lot of other things that suffer right along with that, including your life expectancy. So it's the first one of the Ten Commandments with a specific, in which a specific result is promised if the command is obeyed. Now I'm thinking, how do we apply this? So it's talked about in the Old and New Testament. How do we apply this? You know, the command to honor parents, like most commands, is probably easiest to appreciate when you go to Bible school or a Bible study and you sit around and you talk about it, right? I enjoy that as much as anyone, don't get me wrong, and I think it has a role. But if I'm just having a theological discussion on how I should honor my parents, that's not too bad. I can go along with that. But you know, where this command, like other commands, gets difficult is when I actually have to practice it in everyday life. So how should I be practicing it today as a 30-some-year-old man with my own family? For example, it'd probably be better for me to figure that out before I tell youth how they should do it. You know, as the first command given with promise, it is also the first command of the Ten Commandments that involves relating to another human, if you will. I realize that worshiping God and all that can involve others. At the same time, the focus was more how I need to respect and honor God in the first four commandments. Now you get to the fifth, and there's a real shift in now how I am supposed to relate to someone else. And if anything, I think this makes this subject tricky, if I can use that word, because you have a very wide variety of parents and children, right? My dad and my relationship was a certain way. And other parents may have a totally different relationship with his son or daughter. And so there's a wide variety. And so I can't necessarily this morning preach on this subject and say exactly maybe what you need to hear, because you face a somewhat different tack than what I do. At the same time, I think we can look at principles that affect all of us. So one question that this whole thing, if you just take the Bible verses, does this mean honor your father and your mother? Does that mean that my father and mother have complete and unending control of their children's lives as long as they're alive? And that would raise another question. What if, and thankfully I haven't faced this, but what, let's say that was the case, what would happen if your parents, as they got older, their minds started slipping? Now, are you obligated to obey them, or at what point could you decide that it's okay not to do exactly what they'd say in every area? And I know this may be a bit of a dangerous ground in that at least some of us very quickly can make excuses and dismiss the guidance and caution and the commands of God long before I feel it's justifiable. At the same time, how can we make this practical today, honoring our parents? What is the answer to that question? If you want to, turn to Matthew chapter 15. I'll look at what Christ said. Then I want to look at his actual life some as well. So next bit will be from the Gospels. Matthew chapter 15, verse 3. They were after Christ, I guess you could say, for letting his disciples eat without washing their hands. But then his reply to them, and he brings up this commandment. So, Matthew chapter 15. Matthew 15, verse 3. But he, Christ, answered and said unto them, why do ye also transgress the commandment of God by your tradition? Verse 4, for God commanded, saying, honor thy father and mother, and he that curseth father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, whosoever shall say to his father or his mother, it is a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, and honor not his father or his mother, he shall be free. Thus have ye made the commandment of God of none effect by your tradition. Ye hypocrites, well did Isaiah the prophet prophesy of you, saying, this people draweth nigh unto me with their mouth, and honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. So Christ brings up this thing of honoring your father and mother, and he says the way you're practicing this is, you say, yes, it says that, but really you can be, liberated from your commitment to your parents if you go through this certain traditional process, which I don't claim to understand. But he's saying basically if you did this thing, gave this gift to the temple, made this vow, whatever, you could then say, well, mom and dad, I'm free from my obligations to you, basically. And you know, he talks very clearly about that. He says, ye hypocrites. In one hand, you're picking on me for breaking a tradition that really doesn't affect any more than maybe physical health. And yet, you break commandments that go far beyond physical health into honoring your parents. So I want to take 3 points out of this passage that I just read, Matthew chapter 15. The first one is, I don't feel, according to what Christ says, is that there is not and there should not be a systematic and presumptuous neglecting of parents and our honor to them. And so going back to the thing, I said, where's the statute of limitations? At what point am I free now to not honor my parents, to not obey them? And I want to answer that maybe more in detail, but there's no statute of limitations. I can never say that now I am free of the obligation to honor my parents. Now, there might be ways, I personally feel that honor might be executed in different ways at different stages, but at the same time, I can never say, doesn't matter. They're old fogies, it's done, I fulfilled my 20 years of servitude, whatever. Okay, that's point one. Point two, the only legitimate reason for not deliberately putting into practice a commandment God has given is if in the deliberate practice of that commandment, we violate another command or principle. So I hope you can follow me. So the only excuse I feel I could say that I shouldn't, and there's a lot of nuances, but that I should, where the only area I can say that I'm free from sin, if you want to say it that way, in not doing what my parents want to some degree, is where there's another command or principle that would come in play that would be violated by following that. And I'll cover some of those in a minute. So bear with me if you think that sounds strong. Then the third, when we find commands like this that seemingly bring conflict, I think we have to start by carefully and honestly searching our own heart, its motives and its desires, and take the way of humility and complete surrender. And that may be different in different situations. You know, at one point, being broken and humble may mean that I submit myself to my parents' thoughts even when I do not deem it necessary or even very good. But it could also mean that I will find it necessary to sacrifice our relationship, a relationship with them, and their good opinion of me if it leads contrary to what God would have. And we'll get into that a bit more. So I'd like to look at these additional principles. I think I have four of those. So additional principles to consider. The first one is just briefly Acts chapter 5, verse 29. Peter and John before the council were being asked not to preach. And Peter and the other apostle answered and said, "We ought to obey God rather than men." I feel that principle pertains, whether it's parents, whether it's civil government, whatever. Is if, as all authority, as all human authority, excuse me, let me go back. All legitimate human authority, I feel, comes from God. I'm not saying that those people have human authority are all serving God, but I say all legitimate human authority comes from God. So therefore, where it conflicts with God, we have to choose God, because after all, where I as a father, for example, would ask something of my daughters that is contrary to what God teaches, I no longer have any authority. I might still exercise control, but I don't have authority if I'm asking something in direct conflict with God. God is the source of any legitimate authority man has. Therefore, as the source, his is a higher and greater authority that must be followed at the expense of the lesser. Okay, that's the first principle. The second principle in Matthew chapter 10, verse 34 through 39. I'd just like to read these. Matthew 10, verse 34. Christ says, "Think not that I am come to send peace on the earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth not, excuse me, that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He that taketh not up his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. He that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it." So can I use these verses? Let's say I have strain in my relationship with my parents. Are these verses saying, "Yeah, look, Dad, look, Mom, it says Christ came to set a sword, so we got problems expected"? Is that what is the use of these verses? I don't think these verses are an excuse for not getting along. But I do think they are explaining the difference in focus between Christians and non-Christians. So if you find yourself in any relationship or any authority structure where the one is not a Christian and the other is, you will inevitably have some of this conflict because there's a different focus, a different call, a different desire. So in such situations, wholly following God does mean that we will at times find ourselves crosswise with those who are not following God. In such a situation, we must choose God over the commendation and goodwill of even, parents. And again, I would like to caution, because of human nature, this is not something, doing this is not something that's done lightly or dismissively. It's not something that should cause, it is something that if needed to be done should cause great pain and sadness. This principle is not a loophole, but an execution of motives, a choosing of kingdoms. It makes me think of one young married man who felt that he needed to place himself in a more spiritual church setting. You remember that when Leroy Kaufman was here? I think he talked about that and how he went over the field to talk to his parents, lived on an adjoining farm, and they just could not understand his concerns. And he felt that the path God had for him was more important than following at face value what his parents wanted. But if you remember his story of that, the pain, the anguish that caused him, he talks about falling down in the hayfield and just crying for a long time. You know, it's not something that should ever be done lightly. The next principle I want to look at, this is thinking of Christ in the temple. You know, at 12 years of age, the Bible tells us, I won't read all these verses, but Jesus accompanied his parents to the temple for the feast. And after the feast, his parents traveled home expecting him to be traveling with friends. At the end of the day, they couldn't find him, so they turned around, and after 3 days, they found him there talking with the teachers, the preachers of the day. And when he was found, his mother, I think it was, asked him, "You know, why did you do this to us?" And he says, "Don't you know I must do my father's business?" I'll just read that, Luke 2, verse 48. And when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. Verse 49, notice his response. And he said unto them, How is it that ye sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my father's business? You know, Jesus had a different focus. He had a different calling from what his parents knew and understood. And how did he relate to this? Verse 51 of the same chapter there says, And he went down with them, went home, came to Nazareth, and was subject unto them. So Jesus' earthly parents did not understand, they did not comprehend, they did not grasp who he was and what his father's business really was. But at the same time, I guess that how it says he was subject unto them, I think it's the next verse would tell us that he grew in stature and in favor with God and man. That all said, you all know the story of Christ's life well enough. Is did he stay there for the next 70 years, however long their life expectancy was? He didn't, did he? Seems he served at roughly an additional 18 years, best we can tell, 18 plus 20. And then he laid down, the day came when he laid down those carpenter tools, when he brushed off that sawdust and pursued this greater calling. And I'd like for you to notice how his family responded to him. I'll read some verses. The first one's actually more of a prophecy in Psalm 69, verse 7 through the first part of 9. You can just listen to this, Psalm 69, verse 7. Because for thy sake I have borne reproach. The shame hath covered my face. I became a stranger unto my brethren, that's my family, and an alien unto my mother's children, an outcast. For the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. If we would jump to the New Testament, in Mark chapter 3, verse 21, it says, And when his friends, and if you look up the word friends in Greek, it actually means those near to him, near of kin, near of relationship. Those near to him heard of it, his ministry, and how he was being overwhelmed with people at that point. They went out to lay hold on him, for they said that he is beside himself. Has anybody ever said that you're beside yourself? Seriously? That means you're crazy, in my words. So there was some conflict in this home as Jesus followed the path God had for him. You know, there comes a time and a day when I feel a child has to follow God's plan, even if parents do not support and bless that step. I'd like to read Luke chapter 8, verse 19 through 21 then. Then came to him his mother and his brethren, and could not come at him for the press. And he was told, it was told him by certain which said, Thy mother and thy brethren stand without, desiring to see thee. And he answered and said unto them, My mother and my brethren are those which hear the word of God and do it. You know, there comes a day, there is a time when we must choose and make God and his people of greater importance and import than blood connections, than natural obligations. And one last one down this vein, in John chapter 7, verse 2 through 5. Now the Jews' feast of tabernacle was at end. And his brethren, Jesus' family again, therefore said unto him, Depart hence, and go into Judea, that thy disciples also may see the works that thou doest. For there is no man that doeth anything in secret, and he himself seeketh not to be known openly. If thou do these things, show thyself to the world. But then the phrase I really want you to remember, it says, For neither did his brethren believe in him. I don't know exactly where, it seems maybe Joseph had passed away before Jesus' ministry. Mary, we don't know exactly. Evidently, some of these ended up believing in the future. But Christ was not understood on the family level as he went into his ministry and the plan that God had for him. I think that's quite clear. You know, as we seek God and his kingdom and his glory, where parents do not understand and do not support us in that, we still need to follow God's will and way, but do it carefully. So that brings me back to the question, how much should parents control and direct their children's lives? I find it interesting that in both New Testament passages that I read to you, where children are told to obey their parents, Can anybody tell me what the next verse after that section is? Fathers or parents, don't provoke your children. And so definitely, as in all relationships, there's two things at work here. We can't necessarily separate them, even though to some degree maybe we have to try. As in all relationships, the parent and child relationship is best when both focus on what God asks of them. Yet we cannot disconnect this relationship from the effect that we have on each other. So I have four things that I feel a wise parent would never decide for their child. And I do this simply because I feel there are some aspects where we have to be clear, and I feel there's scripture for this. I'll share that. There are some things a parent may not try to decide for their child, and a parent that does is being foolish, and I think God provides a way to work through that. Number one, before I get into that, one thing I want to be clear is when I say a parent should not decide these things for their child, I'm not saying that a parent should not be there for the child, right? There's a difference. There's a difference between me deciding that you should or should not do something versus me being there to help you along if that's your choice. So let's be clear there. Okay, number one. The first one I would think that a parent should not do for the child is when God is calling, they can't answer for the child, and neither can they say exactly when a child should respond to that call. As a parent, I need to point my children to God. Yet in that pointing, there should never be pressure or a pushing them into it. It won't work. And I know that's probably a fine line. If you dearly love someone, how can you point them in the right way without maybe subconsciously putting some pressure on? And I'm not sure that my mind is keen enough to totally cut between that for you. But I do feel that much damage is done by parents that put pressure onto a child to become a Christian rather than being there to assist the child in the process. I have to think of maybe this is a little more extreme case, and I'm not promoting this necessarily, but I did have to think of this. I knew of a very conscientious young lady. Just, I guess she was born that way more than I was. And so, you know, I don't know what you think, but she was 12, then 14, then 16. She didn't make a commitment. I guess I've always, to be honest, admired her parents in some way. I don't know what all happened, I'm sure. But I think she was 18, almost 19, when she finally became a Christian. And like I say, I'm not necessarily saying it's ideal, but she had a very sensitive conscience, and for her, it just took her a long time to come to the place of actually seeing herself as a sinner before God. Would she have liked to take the step before then? I'm sure she would have. Who likes to be the odd one out? Who likes to be considered a heathen by the people around you? That's not fun. I was old enough that I sort of know how the pressure that we as Mennonites can bring to bear on each other, even though I wasn't that old. And, you know, if her parents, personally, I don't know, I can't go in and dissect all that for you 100%, but I really feel from what I know of the situation, her parents were exceedingly wise in that if she would have made a commitment under pressure, duress, because this is what mom and dad want, I don't think she would be the Christian that I know her to be today. I really believe that. And I guess I have a pretty deep concern about some of the trajectories I see in our churches in this very point. You're welcome to disagree with me. But I personally wonder if not way too much of this happens in our settings. Whether it's here, whether it's other places that I've been privileged to work with young people, it seems to me that many of our young people are part of our churches because it's expected. It's what dad and mom want. It's the easiest way not to be the odd one out. And if I can say this charitably, it's having a negative effect on our church, our churches. And before you just dismiss this thought, would you please read Luke chapter 14, verse 25 through 35. I strongly believe that I, as a parent, as a Christian parent, should want nothing more than seeing my children walk in God's way. Absolutely. I don't want to discourage it. I want to encourage it every way I can. But where that encouragement turns into pressure or into duress to take this step, I have now joined a negative camp. If I, as a Christian parent, have a child that comes and says they want to be a Christian, I by all means need to be there. I need to understand. But I also, as part of it, rather than jumping 10 feet high with joy and just leading them through some words to say, I have to help them count the cost. Because unless that cost is really counted, I question what's going to happen to their Christian life in the future. And I've had to struggle way too many dear young people struggling severely because parents didn't do that. They didn't really sit down and help the child. Is this really what I want? Am I really sold out to God? So bear with me on that one and consider it. Number two, another thing that a wise parent should never decide for their child is their life's vocation, work, and or ministry. And I want to say this carefully. I mean this in perpetuity, if you know what I mean by that. Dad asked me to help him paint houses for a number of years as a teenager, and I thought painting was the stupidest thing a guy could do. I just didn't seem like a manly job at all to me. I rebelled. I was an ornery boy in a lot of ways. But looking back, that didn't harm me one bit. I'm not talking about asking your son, your daughter to learn some things that are unpleasant. That's not what I mean. But what I mean is trying to put them on a lifetime. Well, you read books, you know, you need to be a doctor, you need to be a missionary, you should be a preacher, whatever it is. We don't do any of that, do we? Or do we? So it's, by all means, teach your children useful trades. Help them become useful in this world. But finally, at the end of the day, when they have to decide what to pursue, what to do, be there as an advisor, but don't push. If you value a relationship, let them make that choice. Because after all, you want to see them every family gathering doing something they hate doing just because of you? Anyway, that's on an earthly sense. Again, for scripture on that, I would point you to John 21, verse 20 through 22. And I won't read those necessarily. But another thing I would like to insert here, and I'm not saying we have this here necessarily. I've heard of it happening, so I guess it could potentially happen to me. But sometimes parents struggle when their child or their married child and spouse feel called to a work, maybe some other place, and they like grandchildren close or whatever all it can be. Just human things, you know. And I've heard of pressure coming through that. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate. I'm not saying there's never a place to say, well, we'd miss you and couldn't you please. But, you know, at the end of the day, what do I want? Do I want a child that's wholly following God with all their heart as a parent? Or do I want a child that just makes me feel comfortable and cozy? What do I really want? What's a greater value? And here's something else I've seen time and time again. Is so often, parents, grandparents that have cozy, have everything around them, end up not having very good relationships. You know what? I don't know. I say this being a number of years removed from it. But if God somehow calls my children to the other side of the world, please go. Please go. Am I going to miss you? Absolutely. But I'd rather have you there serving God than at home being a bump. Number three. The third thing a wise parent would never decide for their child is who they will marry. I'll just read 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39. It says, the wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth, talking about marriage. But I want you to notice the next part. But it says, but if her husband be dead, she is at liberty to be married in whom she will, only in the Lord. And in teaching my class at Bible school, that's what I call the choice principle. It makes it very clear that a widow is free to marry whom she will, of course, in the Lord. And I guess I feel that goes for all Christians. The last thing I should be deciding is who somebody else should marry, even my children. Of course, there's a place to caution them, to guide them, to tell them the results of a bad marriage and all that. But I find it interesting that in spite of all the bumbling and stumping and crashing around that youth do, somehow sincere youth often end up doing better than what you ever think they would. And when mom and dad start messing into that thing, I've seen a lot more negative results than I've seen positive. Let them marry whom they will when the Lord, of course, be there for them and guide them. Number four. The fourth thing a wise parent would never do for their child is decide how their home, now that they're getting married, how their home will function. Matthew chapter 9, verse 4 through 6, he says this, "And Jesus answered and said unto them, Have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore there are no more twain, there are no more two, but one flesh. Wherefore, what God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." I would like to suggest to you that, especially in our culture, or churches, whatever you want to call it, we would never be guilty of putting them asunder. We always call that divorce. But I think I've seen many parents that are guilty of pulling asunder marriages, not through separation and divorce, but by messing where they don't belong. You are now on the sidelines. Stay there. A wise child will come and ask you how to do this, but don't go messing into your children's marriages. Generally, you are much better in praying than you are in messing. Are you guilty of pulling a child, your children's marriage? Okay, back to youth. If your parents are, those of us who have parents, if your parents are really and unduly trying to control or influence you in any of these areas, I guess the first thing I would suggest to anybody, I think it's mandatory that you find counsel and direction on how to respond from reputable church leaders, other Christians that you know are grounded and settled, and they can hopefully help you, because I can't give a blueprint on how all this should work. But what should a child do whose parents are continually, to use the Bible word, provoking them? What do you do? Makes me think of a thing I saw years ago, and I still have it and still use it. It's respect. Sort of like honor. Respect, give it to get it. That's simple. Respect, give it to get it. You know, one of the things that's probably most galling to youth, to teenagers, to children, whatever age, is when they feel like they're the little boy that can never grow up. I don't know. And whether that's older brothers or whether it's dad, that just rubs, doesn't it? Just the little guy that can never grow up to anything. I don't know. Maybe girls don't have that problem. I haven't tried it from your side of it, so I would guess it has maybe some different twists, but probably not that different a nuance. And so maybe you think that dad, mom, just don't. You know, it'd be one thing to honor them if they honored you at all, so to speak. But you just can't. I mean, they don't try, and why should I? You know, you can't fix your parents. I'm not suggesting that. At the same time, if you feel your parents struggle with this, I would suggest become the most honorable young person you can be. That's the way to help work through this. Regardless of how others may be, God still has a right way for me in relating to them. In God's view of relationships, failure on the part of another is not an excuse, and it does not liberate me to do wrong. So no matter how wrong your parents are, no matter how wrong someone else in your life is, there is never an excuse for you to start doing things differently from what God would want you to. Your job is still to honor. You know, in many of the strained parent and child relationships I have witnessed, there's often what I will call a deadlock in forgiving. And this deadlock in forgiving happens because I look at the other person as being the one that should ask for forgiveness. And you know, this goes for any relationship. If I waited in my marriage, let's say, till Debbie would come and say, "I'm sorry about something," how good of a marriage do you think I would have? The best way to a good marriage, the best way to a good parent-child relationship is to be the one that races to say, "I'm sorry," when you messed up. Be the one, the first one to say, "I'm sorry." And hopefully you collide on the way there. As in any relationship, if the fault is all on the other party's part, there is usually no way to resolve it. And I hope you understand, don't have time to expound on this a lot, but you are more in control and responsible than what you think you are. So now I'd like to bring this down to some things you can do in a parent and child relationship. And I'm not saying, I know in some ways I'm probably leaning a somewhat negative because that's the ones that ask questions probably. But so I'm thankful for the good ones, but I'll just say there's some things you can do. And I would say this, even if you have a super relationship with your dad and mom, still do this. The first one is be willing to take the initiative. So I'll just give you one illustration. For me, as my late teens, I had some pretty severe moral failure struggles. And you know, it was so easy for me to sit on my hands and wish dad or somebody that was responsible would come ask me, how is it going? And I would sort of excuse myself that they didn't. You know, that's really their job. And I went. Finally, I had to get to the place where I was willing to take the initiative. I was willing to go say, I need help. And interestingly enough, while that wasn't necessarily, I can't say that I've had victory from that day forward, it definitely was a turning day. So maybe dad, mom, don't share and include you in the way you wish they did. How about you including them? So if you would just go ask your parents, these parents that you struggle with, if you would just go include them in your life so they don't ask you about what you like, how about you ask them what they like? Say, Dad, we got a youth activity tonight. What time would you like for me to be home? Like, ooh. He always went to curfew if I didn't say something. How would that be? Whatever it is, maybe you're dating. Maybe it's in a courtship and you say, Dad, we'd like to be together or take this trip or do. How would you feel about that? You have some thoughts for me? Include them. Make it your part. You know, one thing I don't think that youth will ever believe hearing from me is how many parents I've seen who are intimidated by their children. And that sounds really funny. And I still remember the first time I found out that I intimidated somebody, and I thought it was totally crazy, really. I couldn't figure out how I could intimidate anybody. And you know, as a youth, I think most youth that I've ever seen have never felt like there was even a chance they could intimidate their dad and mom. But the fact is, talking to dad and mom, I've often found out they were. Don't ask me how that all works, but go talk it out. And let's say you combine that natural, that intimidation that happens from a know-it-all youth and a parent that's not sure how to respond. You combine that with a conscientious parent who really wants to give their child space to grow up and be their own person without being controlling. You so quickly create this vacuum between each other that is nothing more than just misunderstandings, lack of communication. And whoever you are, whether you're a parent or a child, I would just really encourage you, just sit down and talk it out. And maybe it starts with nothing more than a fussy parent. I'm a fussy parent. I don't say that proudly. But if I see my daughter's doing something that I think could be done better or that I think is stupid, I have a tendency to tell them pretty loud and fairly loud. I hope I don't yell. And fairly detailed how this is really foolish and give them the 10 best reasons why this is the most idiotic thing I saw today yet. And you know, as a child, I somehow can remember being the child. And when dad did that, it didn't feel so great. But now that I'm the dad, I just really feel it's necessary. I don't know. It's sad, isn't it? And I'm trying to grow. But at the same time, I'd like to help youth to understand, maybe look at it as love to some degree rather than hatred or being despised, because I really honestly love. I mean, so if I'm out there, and I had to think of this recently, is when we go fishing as a family, which is thankfully fairly frequently, I see some stupid things happen. I mean, I'm talking unreal. And so I have to instruct this. It may be dangerous, and at worst, I'd really love for these people to catch fish, but if they're going to do it the way they're doing it, they're never going to catch any. But, you know, it's sort of, if I'm not real careful, and I've had to apologize numerous times, a bit of impatience creeps in here. Next thing we know, it's a little bit strained. And we have especially one person that just, they can spout their wisdom, and so I question their wisdom, and then I'm just going to be quiet. Well, you know, that's not the way to a good relationship on either side, and maybe both of us have to grow. I would say this So many parents, and I would probably even go as far to say as most parents, would be delighted to be more involved in their child's life. How would it be if we as children invited them along? Number two, apologize where you have been and done wrong. And I would hazard a guess that no matter how faulty and messed up your parents have been, you have not been, I have not been, a perfect child in every way all the time. So, start it by just apologizing. You know, so many relationship issues drag on for 10, 20, even 30, 40, 50 years. Because no one is brave enough, man enough, woman enough to admit that I was wrong. How stupid is that? Please don't let that happen to you. Number three, another thing that we can do is look for the good in your parents, buried as it may be. When you're 16, I don't know if you're all, I hope not all 16, 17, 18 year olds were the way I was, but sometimes that good seems buried awful deep, but it's still there. Dig it up, come on. Give you something profitable to do. I would say this as well. I hope you can hear me. If you can find nothing good about your parents, or if the good you can find, you have to concede very grudgingly, I would suggest that the biggest problem in your whole relationship is no further than your own heart. Number four, if you find yourself in a situation where your parents desire and or ask things that are in conflict with what God is asking of you, remain respectful and deferential to them. So maybe you find yourself on a path where they just don't feel like that's right. They're just not supporting. They're not there. I still think I owe it to my parents. I want to be careful here. I don't think I can live my life necessarily on their shadow, doing every small thing the way they would want it done. At the same time, I think I need to give my dad and mom opportunity to express themselves to me if they have a concern. And I need to be quietly listen them out. Whether I agree or disagree doesn't matter. Honor still needs to stand. I should still ask for their input. And if it seems, if it's one of those things that I cannot change in good faith before God, then probably I need to ask them a question is what can I do to resolve conflict if I can't change what you don't like here? Another question, if you can ask this respectfully, don't do it flippantly, would be, do you really want me to follow what you think more than what I understand God is asking? And after that's all over, or maybe not over yet, but still include them in your life. Don't give up on them. You know, I think one of the saddest things that happens is when there is strain between parents, children, family, whatever it is. It's so easy to say, well, especially if you have your own home, you live in a different community, I can just sort of not spend too much time with them. I can just sort of avoid them without really looking like I did, almost. I'm busy, I have a crazy schedule, so if there's some stress, just stay away. You know, friends, that's not God's way. Put yourself in their path. Include them. Don't give up. So, I guess that brings back the question to you. Those are some thoughts on how I feel I should honor my parents. How do you honor your parents? And I had to think of what I saw recently, and I don't want to be critical of this. It's just, to me, it was just a loud sermon on how we as humans tend to be. Over Father's Day, some weeks ago, I saw a young man I know of who is not at all following what his dad would like for him to. Put a picture of his dad on his status and saying, I love this man. Yet in his daily life, he's doing anything but what his dad would want. Is that true? I don't need to decide for him. But I found it interesting, in Father's Day, I'm not saying across, by no means, but I found it interesting how some people sort of soothe Father's Mother's Day, they soothe their conscience or something by sending a card, by posting something nice, and the rest of the time they just live the way they want to. Is that honoring my parents? You know, as life continues and changes, often the biggest challenge in honoring my parents is not so much one of doing exactly as they say or did and everything, but it is one of applying the lessons of life to the situations I face. So the way I live for God today is the way that I honor a Christian parents, even if some things are different. Remember, where your parents are, you have never been. Where you are, your parents have been. A wise child will consider this carefully. Then there's a poem, song. I've heard it sung. I won't sing it. But just thinking of parents getting older, moving on. It says, wonderful things of folks are said when they have passed away. And I changed some of the words briefly. A bit, I mean. When they have passed away, roses adorn the narrow bed over the sleeping clay. Praises are heard not by the dead. Roses they cannot see. Let us not wait till souls have fled, a grateful child to be. Faults are forgiven when they lie cold in the narrow bed. I hope they are. It's pretty bad if they're not by then, at least. Let us forgive them before they die. Now should the words be said. Give them the roses while they live, trying to cheer them on. Useless the flowers that you give after the soul.